listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Elliot Forrest, and today for Leonard Lopate. We're in the middle of one of the hottest months on record. An oppressive drought is gripping much of the United States, while massive floods inundate other parts of the globe. Arctic ice is retreating, and Greenland has experienced what NASA has dubbed an extreme melt event this summer. All this is just a small taste of what our future weather might look like if climate change continues at its current pace. We're joined now by Michael Lemonick, one of the co-authors of Global Weirdness: Severe Storms, Deadly Heat Waves, Relentless Drought, Rising Seas, and the Weather of the Future. It's published by Pantheon Books. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Is it fair to say just the cover of the book is a little depressing?
Well, yeah, it's meant to be. So it's absolutely fair.
And as a warning and information for those who want to pursue it further.
Yeah. I mean, the idea that climate change is going to lead to very likely going to lead to some really severe problems for a lot of people is not a new idea. And yet it does not seem to have sunk in to the public consciousness. So we're trying to help it.
Many people are trying to explain the unusual weather we've been experiencing, particularly this summer, as a symptom of climate change. Is it still too early to connect the dots between these two things?
It's too early to connect the dots with a really thick, solid black line. The reason is that climate change pushes on weather and weather events in a kind of a statistical way. So you can't say this particular heat wave was caused by climate change. What you can say is that in a warming world, these things are going to come along more and more often.
And do we know if extreme weather, or as you called it, global weirdness, is actually happening more frequently than it used to?
Yeah, we know that some forms of extreme weather, at least, are happening more frequently. So heat waves are coming more often, and they're more severe, and they're lasting longer. Severe downpours, rainstorms, are happening more often in some places. Droughts seem to be happening more often. Other things we are not statistically confident enough in yet to say for sure, but it's looking as though other events are tied in as well.
I have to say, you know, in this idea of weirdness, the idea that we had snow before Halloween this last year was just weird.
It was weird. And you know, I remember back, I don't know, in the 80s, there was a snowstorm in October. So these things are not unheard of. None of these things is unheard of. The question is, are they happening more often? And will they continue to happen more often as this century plays out? And all the evidence suggests yes.
Let's get into a little science if we can. What exactly is CO2 and why is it so bad for us?
Okay, CO2 is a natural gas. It's a gas that occurs naturally in the atmosphere, comes from natural processes. If not for CO2 in our atmosphere, the Earth would actually be frozen solid, because we've known since the 1800s that CO2 in the atmosphere actually traps heat. The planet Venus has a thick atmosphere of CO2, and its surface temperature is something like 800 degrees Fahrenheit. And that's not just explained by the fact that Venus is closer to the sun. Mars has virtually no atmosphere, and it's freezing cold. So CO2 is a natural product of the Earth. It helps us by trapping enough heat to make life possible on Earth. But since the Industrial Revolution began in around 1800, we have been adding extra CO2 to the atmosphere by burning fossil fuels. And that extra CO2 is trapping more heat, and as a result, the temperature is going up and the climate is beginning to change.
How much CO2 are we collectively spewing into the atmosphere annually, then?
Oh, it's like something like 30 billion metric tons, which is not really a meaningful number to me. another way to look at it is that for every million molecules of air, there are about 400, just under 400 molecules of CO2 now. There were 270 or so before the Industrial Revolution.
And how long has science really known about the greenhouse effect?
Well, we've known about it in kind of a laboratory setting since the mid-1800s. In the late
I think that would surprise people.
It surprised me when I first learned it. In the late 1800s, a Swedish scientist, whose name I'd rather not try and pronounce, but I guess I have to, Svante Arrhenius.
Okay.
Swedes in the audience, please forgive me. Actually connected the dots between fossil fuel burning and CO2 in the atmosphere and warming of the planet. And he actually came up with the greenhouse theory way back then, more than 100 years ago. he actually thought it was a good thing because at that time they already knew that the Earth had gone through ice ages in the past. And
this will prevent it. This will prevent another one.
Right. That was his feeling.
Yeah.
That it was actually a good thing. And that might be true, except that the temperature is going up faster than any ice age could possibly come upon us. So it might be then in 2,000 or 3,000 years, we'll be happy about this. But in that time, during that time, we're going to be subject to a very, very disrupted climate.
We're in that period right now where people go, wow, it's kind of warm today. I'm happy for global warming.
I have to admit, I said it myself one day in February when we were having an unusually warm winter.
Right, right. But it's the canary in the coal mine at this point.
It's the canary in the coal mine, and I was happy that it was warm in February. I was not so happy when we had torrential rains in late summer, and we had a snowstorm in October, and I lost power both times. It's on balance appears to be not a very good thing.
So you mentioned that it started during the Industrial Revolution. I'm only guessing that that's been a rapid increase of CO2 in the atmosphere since then.
Right. So it started off relatively a relatively mild increase because there weren't that many people, and we were driving a lot of cars, and we had no electricity back then. It was mostly just steam engines. But in the 20th century, as the world industrialized rapidly, the emissions really began to shoot up.
I'm Elliot Forrest in for Leonard Lopate. My guest is Michael Lemonick, one of the authors of Global Weirdness, Severe Storms, Deadly Heat Waves, etc. It gets a little worse. You for yourself in this book, you place 2100, a little less than 100 years from now, as sort of what will happen then. Where do you anticipate the temperatures going in 90 some odd years?
Well, it's not me. This is all based on everything in the book is based on scientific research. And so what the scientists tell me is that, first of all, we don't know exactly. It depends on some factors that we don't yet understand. In part, it depends on how much CO2 we'll continue to put into the atmosphere. But the upper end of the range is about 8-9 degrees Fahrenheit of temperature increase for a global average by that time.
8 or 9 degrees,
yeah.
Globally.
Yeah.
So let's say, for example, what happens to the sea levels at that temperature?
Okay, so as the ocean warms up as a result of global warming, the water in the ocean actually expands. And so sea level rises for that reason. But the other thing that happens is that ice begins to melt in mountain glaciers and more ominously on Greenland and in Antarctica. And the ice also begins to slide without melting into the sea, dumping more icebergs into the ocean and raising sea level that way. And the current best projections are that we will see between 2 and 6 feet of sea level rise by 2100. We've already seen 8 inches since about 1880.
And this is globally?
This is globally. In some places, the increase will be less for all sorts of reasons. In some places, the land is actually rising. It's rebounding still after the glaciers retreated. The weight was lifted off it, and the land is slowly rising back up. So if you happen to live in a place where that's happening, sea level won't rise as much. Some places are sinking. You'll see a greater sea level rise there. And ocean currents also play a role. So that's a global average.
So I've seen the movies. I see what happens to New York when we get 6 or 8 feet of water. I mean, basically, without any major changes in policy and CO2, are we looking at New York City underwater?
We're not looking at New York City underwater most of the time. We're looking at parts around the edges.
I mean, anything above the 8th floor of someone's apartment.
it's not quite that bad.
Okay.
But what scientists really worry about is not just the sea level rise. I mean, say it does go up 3 feet. I was at the New Jersey shore last week, and the beach that I was on would probably be mostly underwater, but the houses behind the beach would not. The problem happens when a storm comes along, as they do very frequently. It doesn't have to be a hurricane. It can be a tropical storm or even just an ordinary northeaster, or nor'easter, I guess they're called. And when that happens, a surge of water gets pushed ahead of the storm, and the storm surge combined with sea level rise poses a danger of really pretty serious and catastrophic flooding in many parts of the country.
And what other kind of havoc do you see around the globe with sea levels that high?
Well, I mean, that's really the main problem. You've got the ocean washing in, destroying barrier islands like the ones that protect New Jersey and much of the East Coast from the sea. So with the barrier beaches gone, the land behind it is open to flooding. Also, when sea level rises and you've got rivers flowing into the sea, the rivers have a harder time doing that flowing. So cities that are in river deltas or in or near river deltas are likely to experience more flooding as the rain backs up as it tries to shove its way into a higher sea.
You go into great detail in this book about the models and how you create these models and how you know these models of what the weather is like in the future and what it was like hundreds of years ago. How assured are you that these models are correct?
Well, if you look at any one model, you are not necessarily assured that it is correct down to the precise detail. The atmosphere is a really complicated place, and all sorts of things affect it. The atmosphere interacts with the surface of the Earth and with the oceans, and they feed back on each other, and they swirl around, and it's really very complicated. So what scientists do, first of all, they have many different models that they use. Different scientific groups construct their models in different ways and emphasize different factors in the climate. And when the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, puts together its major reports every 5 or 6 years, they take a bunch of these models together and look collectively at what they suggest for future future climate change. So the numbers that you see are based on averages of a number of different models. The idea is that if any one model is weak in one area, it'll be made up for by strengths in another model. But the models are far, far better than they were 25 years ago when I first began writing about this. They're much more precise and much more complex, and they can deal with a lot more factors. And so they're more reliable now than they were back then. But even so, you would not trust them if that's all you had to go on. I mean, it is still just a kind of a video game. It's a simulation of the Earth's atmosphere. And you have to be able to test it against something real. And what climate scientists do is they go back. They go back to conditions as they were in, say, the 1800s. And they look at the amount of CO2 that was in the air and the temperature and the conditions back then, and they feed those into the models and run them forward. And they say, do our models accurately predict what the 20th century was going to be like?
You're actually predicting today from back then.
Right. They call it post-diction, I think. And sure enough, the models do pretty reliably reproduce the conditions of the 20th century.
And how far back do these models go? Have you gone to thousands of years, tens of thousands of years ago to know what the temperatures were then?
Well, so I don't believe that they do that much with models that far back, but they do have a great deal of information about what conditions were like tens and hundreds of thousands of years ago. And that also obviously feeds into our predictions for the future. One of the very most powerful sets of data that they've got are ice cores drilled out of Antarctica and Greenland. So these are basically long, long cylinders of ice that go back hundreds of thousands of years. And within that ice at different levels is trapped little air bubbles. And those air bubbles are like a time capsule. They preserve the atmosphere as it was 50,000 years ago, 100,000 years ago, 500,000 years ago. And you can look at that air and the ice surrounding it and figure out what the temperature was long before thermometers existed and what the concentration of greenhouse gases were at that same time. And you can develop a relationship. You can say, well, when CO2 is at this intensity in the atmosphere, temperatures tend to be high. And when it was lower, they tend to be lower. And there's actually a very good correlation.
You state in the book that every American puts 20 tons of CO2 into the atmosphere every year.
Yeah.
So what am I doing? How am I doing that?
Well, if you live in New York City, you're actually probably doing better than average. But those of us who,
although I drive a lot.
Okay, well then forget it. I mean, we drive cars. We use a lot of electricity, a lot of energy. We heat our houses. We heat our buildings, we fly around on vacation. Any very highly developed country where there's a very high standard of living tends to have a pretty high carbon footprint. Although I have to say that the footprint in Europe is significantly lower.
I'd love to find out if there's a way to reverse this trend that we've been talking about. Can we get to that after we take a little break? I'm speaking with Michael Lemonick about the science of climate change and what the future might bring to our planet's ecosystem. He co-wrote Global Weirdness, Severe Storms, Deadly Heat Waves, Relentless Drought, Rising Seas, and the Weather of the Future. It's published by Pantheon. We'll be back with more after a break. Elliot Forrest in for Leonard Lopate. My guest is Michael Lemonick. He is one of the authors of Global Weirdness. It's about severe storms and relentless drought, rising seas, and the weather of the future. We were talking about CO2 before the break and how it gets into the atmosphere, but it gets into the atmosphere in other ways, including agriculture. So it's probably not just autos and plant emissions. Do we have to rethink how we actually farm and get food to the plates of everyone in the world?
Yeah, it comes from agriculture as soil is tilled up and organic matter in the soil is exposed and decomposes. It also has to do with the manufacture of fertilizer, which is a carbon-spewing process, and the harvesting. Our very mechanized agriculture in the United States is a big contributor to climate change, and there are other greenhouse gases, actually, besides CO2 that are also tied to agriculture. Methane is a big one. Cows eat grass and then they burp out methane.
Seems like a joke, but it's a real problem, right?
It's a real problem. Rotting manure contributes a lot of methane to the atmosphere. Rice paddies lead to methane emissions. There are also some things that I never would have guessed before going into this research. The manufacture of concrete is an enormous emitter of CO2. Concrete is made out of limestone, which has carbon dioxide locked up in it. When that's crushed, it's released, and the energy it takes to make the concrete is very energy intensive. So there are all sorts of things we do to put greenhouse gases in the atmosphere we don't even think about.
How much of this is related to the population? Can the planet actually support 7+ billion people who live here?
Well, that's a great question. It's certainly related to the population because, I mean, imagine the population of the Earth were 500 million. All of our environmental problems would be less as a result because there'd be fewer of us, you know, using stuff and burning stuff and creating waste. But it's also true that vast numbers of people in places like China and India and developing countries use very, very little energy and emit very little CO2. So it sort of depends on which 500 million you allowed to remain on the Earth. If it was us, it wouldn't make that much of a dent. It's certainly not possible for the entire world, the entire 7 billion, to use energy as intensively as we do in the U.S. and have the climate survive at all.
But we're seeing those developing countries like India and China moving more into the middle class and lifestyles like us, probably increasing the problems, I guess.
Right. And China is now, in fact, the biggest CO2 emitter on the planet. They went past us a couple of years ago, not because they use so much per person, but because the population is so big.
So just a little bit more science. The CO2 we use, it goes up into the atmosphere. Does it always stay there? Does it dissipate? Are there things that we can do to help it dissipate or try to control that? What's the mechanism?
Okay, so as I said, CO2 is a natural constituent of the environment, and it gets there through volcanoes and through decomposition of vegetation and through a bunch of natural processes. And there are also natural processes that remove it. The growth of plants, absorption into the ocean, eventually absorption into limestone. And for many thousands of years, the amount that was going into the atmosphere and the amount that was coming out were pretty well balanced. It's all, you can think of it like a bathtub that has a very slow drain and also has a slowly dripping faucet. The water doesn't actually rise higher, stays about the same, even though it's always going in and always draining out. But what we've done is turn up the faucet. We are adding CO2 to the atmosphere faster than any natural process can remove it. So the faucet's turned up, the drain is still mostly closed, levels are rising. Now imagine we turn off the drain suddenly. We cut drastically back on our CO2 emissions. Well, that level in the bathtub is still high, and it's still going to take a very long time to drain out. It actually would take probably a couple of thousand years for the extra CO2 that we've put in the atmosphere to drain out again.
Is technology working on another part of the drain?
Technology is working on it. There are projects afoot to try and figure out ways to suck CO2 back out of the atmosphere. But these are still entirely experimental. There's no technology available yet that can do anything like that.
A caller asked if 350 parts per million of carbon in the atmosphere is an attainable goal. Explain what that means.
Okay, so about 4 years ago, a scientist named James Hansen, who is very eminent, one of the early people who point the finger at our role in global warming, and he came out with a paper that said, I have determined based on my research that, and looking at those past climates I was talking about earlier, that the only safe level of CO2 that we can allow to remain in the atmosphere is 350 parts per million. We're already over 390 parts, so you'd have to actually ratchet that back. And it's not certain that his number is correct. I mean, not everybody agrees with that number, although everybody who's looked at the problem agrees that the less CO2 we have up there, the better. So getting back to 350 parts per million would be an extremely difficult thing to do. You notice, or you may not notice, but I'll tell you that our emissions have really not slowed down very much at all, despite 25 years of alarms going off. And there's no real prospect for any kind of international agreement that would cut back on our emissions. So the levels are continuing to rise. If we started working on it very strenuously today and trying to transform our energy system, we could hope to get back down to 350 parts per million of carbon dioxide within a couple of hundred years. But we're not working on it. So it's anybody's guess whether that's possible or how long it would take.
I keep thinking of solar and wind and nuclear. Is that just even collectively with nuclear thrown in there, is that still just a drop in the bucket compared to our use of fossil fuel?
It is currently, and it is absolutely correct that trying to make a transition to non-fossil fuel sources of energy, non-emitting sources of energy, is a really crucial thing for us to do if we're going to get a handle on this problem. Currently, those renewable sources of energy do not contribute very much to our energy picture. And in order to make a dent in CO2 emissions in any sort of reasonable time, we would have to ramp those up very quickly and very, very high. So it would be a very big commitment.
And a fast one that would need to happen.
And it would have to be fast. And the longer we wait, the faster it would have to be.
There's been talk of the implementation of the cap and trade system for carbon emissions. What's your thoughts on that?
My thoughts are that there's been a lot of talk, but I see no evidence of action. In fact, the Senate failed to approve a bill like that a couple of years ago. I mean, the idea is that one way or another, you could convince people to emit less CO2 if it was either costly for them to do so, if there was some kind of tax on carbon, and that would very quickly make people look for alternatives, and it would make alternatives more competitive economically. Or you could put together a scheme where people would have an incentive to find ways to be more efficient and then sell their extra efficiency to somebody else. The prospects are unclear at this moment. There's no serious movement in either of those directions.
Elliot Forrest in for Leonard Lopate today. My guest is Michael Leminick. He is one of the authors of Global Weirdness, Severe Storms, Deadly Heat Waves, Relentless Drought, Rising Seas, and the Weather of the Future. This is from an organization called Climate Central. What is that?
Climate Central is a nonprofit organization that does scientific research and also does journalism about climate change. It was founded about 4 years ago by a group of climate scientists and interested people who felt that the debate about climate change had become poisoned by political sniping back and forth. There was too much hype on both ends of the spectrum, people saying that we're all going to die tomorrow on one hand and people saying, oh, it's all a hoax, don't worry about it, on the other. And the scientists knew that they were doing a lot of really serious and important work on understanding the climate, and it just was not making it into the public consciousness. So they put Climate Central together to try and change that.
And I wonder about the effect. There was some recent poll that people were still actually, the number of people doubting that climate change was a problem was actually increasing.
Yeah, I different pollsters come to different conclusions about this, but it's clearly not high on the agenda of a lot of Americans. And it's and that is reflected in the fact that politicians are simply not talking about it. It's not part of the presidential conversation at all, because politicians realize that it's not to their benefit to talk about it. People are just not.
And why do you think that is? I mean, I can just admit for myself that, you know, I don't want to cut back on those creature comforts. It's tough for me to think about what we would all have to give up. Is that part of it?
I think that is part of it. It's also that the worst effects of climate change are far into the future. I mean, 2100 is a long way away. And while we may talk about wanting to preserve the planet for our grandchildren, we have day-to-day concerns. We have to pay the mortgage. We have to, get to work. We have to feed the
family. I'm hot in my car right now.
Right, right. So I'm going to turn on the air conditioning. And it is hard for people to put aside day-to-day worries, legitimate worries, and think seriously about what might happen in the future. If you own a house and the roof is looking kind of shoddy and you know that sooner or later you're going to have a leak, well, do you put on a new roof or do you do something else today with your money and say, oh, look, I'll deal with a roof later because it's just not that urgent.
When it caves in.
Yeah.
Mine may do at any moment.
Right.
We have a listener who wants to know, how much is the greenhouse effect related to deforestation?
I'm glad the listener raised the point I should have raised already. It has a lot to do with deforestation. When people cut down forests to clear land for agriculture, for example, those trees are either burned, which releases CO2, or they rot, which releases CO2. And at the same time, the carbon absorbing power of all those leaves that are no longer alive is gone. So you've added CO2 to the atmosphere and you've taken away some of the capacity of the earth to remove it.
And what's the connection between carbon dioxide and the acid in the ocean?
So carbon dioxide is absorbed by the ocean. In fact, a lot of the CO2 that we've emitted since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution has gone into the ocean. And what happens when it does is that it forms a substance called carbonic acid. I didn't quite realize this at the time I started working on the book, but any soda that you drink, including seltzer, is actually slightly acid. It's bad for your teeth because it eats away at the enamel. And that same process is going on in the oceans. The oceans are becoming more acidic, and that's having strong effects on sea life, and it makes corals and other shellfish, gives them more trouble in forming their shells, and that can affect the entire food chain in the ocean, which a lot of us depend on.
The rhetoric is different depending upon whether it's climate change, global warming. Is that important for you as far as the discourse is concerned?
Well, that's why we invented our own term, global weirdness. Some people argue that global warming sounds too benign and nice, so we should call it climate change because that's more accurate, actually. It's not just warming, but it's changing. And other people say, no, climate change is too weak. It sounds, the climate always changes, so we should call it global warming. I don't really know what's a more effective term at communicating what's going on. But I do know that the climate is starting to get weird and it's going to get weirder. And so I think we'll stick with that one.
I remember people attacking, I think it was Al Gore, about global warming when there was a huge snowstorm, saying, well, how could it be getting warmer if there was a snowstorm? But there's actually a real scientific answer to that, right?
There is a scientific answer. And I want to say first that, these objections that people raise to the idea that the globe is warming are not inherently bad questions. They make good common sense. And so it's legitimate to ask, how can you have a big snowstorm if the globe is warming? And the point is that the globe is not warming so much that there will no longer be any freezing days, there will no longer be any snow or ice. It's that those things are going to be less globally. But the atmosphere also can hold more moisture as it gets warmer. And if it's holding more moisture and it happens to be wintertime, the average temperature in New York in January may be, I'm making this up, 30 degrees. It might be below freezing. But and if it goes up a little bit, it's still going to be below freezing. certainly at night, it's still possible to have snowstorms. And with more moisture in the atmosphere, those snowstorms could be more intense. And in fact, they have been in the Northeast in the past couple of years.
They always say follow the money. Is there a financial interest in people denying the climate change and global warming?
I think there probably is for some people. If you make your living selling fossil fuels, it's kind of important to keep selling them. And so you could understand why people would, not necessarily deviously, but be kind of motivated to look for any silver lining, any uncertainty in the science that could allow you to say, well, you know, we just don't know. And in the meantime, let's drive, you know, more miles, let's burn more coal.
I wanted to leave a few minutes for something I hope to be positive in all of this. What are the answers? What do you think the answers are for reversing this? We've touched on it already, but expand on that if you would.
Well, I think you touched on it as well. You talked about the idea that we need to transform the way we use and make energy here and in other parts of the world. And I think we do. And that's a big challenge. I think the only way it's going to happen is if people really do start to understand that the science is real and that the threat is real, and that if we don't act quickly, we could be in big trouble. And if that can happen, and if books like ours can help that happen, people can get a fundamental understanding. I think it'll be kind of like what has happened with smoking. You know, in the 1960s, if I said, well, you know, let's ban smoking in restaurants and on subways and in airplanes, people would have been outraged at that interference with their rights. By now, people know that smoking is a really bad thing and that it's socially unacceptable, and they support all of these forms of legislation. If they felt the same way about emitting carbon, it might well embolden politicians to take the steps they need to take.
I've been speaking with Michael Lemonick about the science of climate change and what the future might bring to our planet's ecosystem. He co-wrote Global Weirdness, Severe Storms, Deadly Heat Waves, Relentless Drought, Rising Seas, and the Weather of the Future. It's published by Pantheon. Fascinating stuff, Michael. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.